This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your disco floor breakups that didn't break us of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
I bet you think you're John Wayne, showing up and shooting down everybody. You're classic in the wrong way, and we all know the end of the story. Cause everyone knows someone who kills the buzz every time they open up their mouth. Yeah, everyone knows someone who knows someone who thinks they're cooler than everybody else. And I think we've seen enough to know that you ain't ever gonna come down. So why don't you giddy up, giddy up?
Listening to Daft Country of Casey Musgraves. That is a song called High Horse, probably a double entendre, I would guess, from her latest album, Golden Hour, which is out today, being Friday. Casey Musgraves is back for her third major label album, and it comes out the same day as an album that I also very much enjoy, which is Girl Going Nowhere by Ashley McBride. I interviewed Ashley in Nashville last week, and I am joined today on the podcast by good friend, Casey Musgraves enthusiast, Natalie Weiner.
Yay.
Yay.
Happy to be here.
Natalie is a staff writer at Bleacher Report, but more importantly for our purposes, is an avid follower of country music.
Yay.
Cares a great deal about the genre, which is something that we appreciate here on the podcast. And also drove in a snowstorm to Reading, Pennsylvania to interview Casey Musgraves for the cover of Billboard magazine.
Woohoo!
Shouts to Billboard magazine.
Yeah.
Shouts to charts.
Exactly. Love charts.
Love data.
Country.
Data.
Love driving in blizzards and almost dying to talk to Casey Musgraves.
The subject of a future country song, undoubtedly.
Exactly. Yeah. Once I switch careers.
Here's
to
the snowy drives that didn't break us. Here's
definitely
to the interview
I'll
topics
drink to that
didn't break us. So this week we are going to talk about Musgraves and McBride, a little bit about what roles they occupy in and outside the genre, and whether it's even useful to be talking about what roles they occupy in and out of the genre. We'll also talk a little bit more broadly about what is happening in country music at the moment and the atomization of the genre.
Ooh, I like that.
I will try very hard not to speak the words Walker Hayes if I can avoid it. But let's start with Casey Musgraves. So, Natalie, you did this interview. This is a very good interview.
Thank you.
Got her talking. You got her comfortable. And Casey Musgraves is someone who likes to talk, but she seemed especially comfortable in this interview. Tell me a little bit about what your perception of her state of mind was at the time that you talked to her, which is what, a couple weeks ago now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would have been end of February.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, she just seemed like super zen and chill. Honestly, going into the
Was it the weed?
No, it didn't appear to be,
okay,
but
checking.
No, she was really hungover when we talked,
okay.
By her own admission.
Okay.
Her husband, who was a
Liddington, She got off at the Lyttington stop.
Oh, yes, she did.
Yeah.
With her husband, apparently, because he had joined her for the tour that weekend. So they were like hanging out, and I guess they got really drunk together and, you know, were having a lot of fun. But then she was hungover. But she still sounded great in performance, as I told her, and she was still lovely to talk to. But yeah, she just seems like very serene and really nice. And honestly, going in, I wasn't totally sure what to expect because, you know, like, I mean, I like her music, but I never really got a great sense of her as a person kind of like through her, you know, time. And she's had some little moments where she's like provoking people and whatnot. And but then she was like so chill.
A fascinating thing about Kacey Musgraves is there is a deeply intimate quality, I think, to the songwriting on the first two records, and yet it is deeply impersonal at the same time.
Yeah.
She manages to write incredibly small songs that feel very lived in that do not feel very personal.
Yeah.
And that is something that I think is uncommon, certainly in Nashville. I mean, it's uncommon for people to write good songs in general. I think she's a good songwriter, but I do agree that there has been like a little bit of a gap.
Disconnect. And also, I think she was like figuring out how to like create a public persona, kind of. Mm-hmm. I think it was, she had a lot of different ideas about what she wanted. It seemed like she has, you know, sort of this aesthetic and like these songs and blah, blah, blah. And she likes traditional country, but she likes pop and whatever. So it was like, it seemed like she was sort of working some stuff out. And on this record, and just kind of talking to her, she seems very centered. She has like very cohesive ideas of what she's looking to do and what she's creating. And like, I don't know, it was kind of awesome to talk to somebody who seems like so at peace, which is rare for an artist, you know.
Should we mention very briefly that you and I first met at a Kacey Musgraves concert?
We can. No, we didn't first meet at a Kacey Musgraves concert.
Was the Kendrick show first? Okay, I didn't remember.
But we talked about Kacey Musgraves.
Yes, correct. But at the Kacey Musgraves show at the Bowery Ballroom, which was her first New York show.
Was it her first one?
I'm pretty sure.
It was definitely one of the early ones.
Yes, I mean, certainly I think of that era, it was the first one. But I mean, she played like a honky tonk. She might have done a rodeo bar show.
Maybe.
A lot of the early conversation from her first two major label records was how she played with the rules of genre.
Right.
And how she interfaced with classic country. Mm-hmm. And I think because she did it in a sort of winking way, but also that was embracing of the firmness of tradition, that appeals to a lot of people. Certainly people who think that if they get actual contemporary hybrid country on them, it like will leave a stain.
Right. She came to sort of mainstream country with this thing like, one, I am an outsider. You know, like she sort of set herself apart very early, which she sort of resists saying now, you know, but it's like, you know, it's pretty clear that you were like, I'm going to do my own thing. And that's great. You know, and that's the reason she was so successful, or one of the reasons. The songs were also good.
And also successful in the way that she was successful.
Right, which you're saying she has all this crossover appeal because she's like Stapleton, like Jason Isbell, like Sturgill. Like, I am not a mainstream country radio star.
I am not that.
And I have this very distinct connection to traditional country, as you're saying, which breeds bona fides, right?
Right.
But also Kacey did it in a way that has like a very like pop flair, especially compared to somebody like, I guess, Stapleton or Isabel or whatever. You know, like she had a much more sort of polished aesthetic, which I actually like honestly didn't love in the first two records. Like the way that they were produced was not awesome for me, like because I loved watching her YouTube videos and just her with a guitar and singing these songs, and I was like, oh my god, these are amazing songs. And then they came out on the record and they were all glossy and whatever. They weren't my favorite, but I do still like the songs themselves.
My favorite Kacey Musgraves thing ever is a YouTube clip of a radio station performance of It Is What It Is.
Yeah. The one where she's like, my grandma calls this
the slut song. Yeah. And she's on the stool and Misa's on the chair. Yo, seriously, go find that. We'll play a little bit of that. Actually, let's just play a little bit of that because that'll blow your head off.
My grandma calls this the slut song. I'm thinking too hard. So put on your shoes and get in your car. And put it in drive and point it this way. You don't have to talk. You don't have to stay. But I ain't got no one sleeping. Maybe I love you. Maybe I'm just
this very clear songwriting talent. She has, you know, she's smart enough to be able to play the field in a way that she can sort of play both sides. You know, she's not alienated from mainstream country. No, she's not getting radio play in any substantive way, but she's still a part of the Nashville community. Mm-hmm. But she's also getting fader covers. She's getting, you know, kind of covered in a...
Shrugs.
Whatever. Well, true. But she's getting coverage in a way that the vast majority of country stars do not.
Right.
And, you know, in the end, it's working out for her, right? She's going to open for Harry Styles. She's open for Katy Perry. You know, she's
great.
Like...
Yeah.
Yeah, she's chilling. She's got it. She's kind of got it all figured out. And so I was happy to see, in talking with her, not only that she seemed really happy in an apparently mm-hmm. genuine way, as insofar as you can tell from spending an hour with someone, it seemed legit. Sure. But also that she is very conscious of not wanting to do the same thing over and over again mm-hmm. and really wanting to sort of expand creatively.
And this record is
this
different.
This is the result yes. of that.
I mean, I think if you can say something about the first two records, they're maybe too cute by a hair.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
And they are narrow.
Yes.
I think because of the slight political moments on those records,
yeah.
it ended up distracting a lot from, is Kacey Musgraves a good singer? Is Kacey Musgraves making incredible songs? Mm-hmm. I think because whether it's something she led with or that was led with on her behalf were these kind of outsiderish or politically progressive things.
Sure.
It took a little bit of the attention off of those questions. This record is maybe the first one where I feel like I'm hearing that and I'm hearing it first
yeah.
before I'm hearing the other stuff.
No, I think that's fair. Like I was going to, when I was sort of thinking about what I was going to say here, it's like, I feel like this record is much more driven by the aesthetic than it is by the content, you know,
yes.
whereas her other records have been the opposite.
Yes.
You know, and honestly, most country music is the opposite. You know, it's mostly not about like the way the song sounds. It's mostly about what they're saying, like 99% of the time.
Sure.
There's a pretty limited range of like kind of sounds that get played on country radio.
No, and that has a lot to do with obviously the Nashville system.
Sure, sure. And
you know,
just the way that it works.
Songwriters get prioritized, bands and producers are sort of after the fact.
Exactly.
But to that point, so the song we opened with, which is High Horse, to me is one of the best songs on this record. I feel like I've seen a lot of people say that this is her best record. Where do you stand on that?
I don't know. I hate ranking questions, but like...
Okay, I'll give you the right answer. The best Kacey Musgraves record is the Christmas album.
You already told me this.
Sorry, it's
I
true.
Mean, whatever, whatever.
But I think this is a good... It's good. I don't know if it's the best
Yeah,
Kacey
I don't think
Musgraves.
It's the best. I think it just has a different set of strengths than our other ones do.
Dead ass.
I really,
so High Horse being one of the more progressive...
Yeah, that's definitely... That's probably the most thoughtful. Sort yeah. of like... stylistically out of her comfort zone once. Mm-hmm. But I just think the whole thing has a really coherent vibe, you know, which is like sort of zen. Mm-hmm. Like I just feel like the whole record is like an exhale, you know, like I just listen to it and I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. this is contentment. I don't feel it, but I understand how it feels maybe listening to this.
Should we listen to one of the more content songs? That's a song that we discussed before we started recording mm-hmm. that I don't like that much, but that you
yeah.
enjoy. Should we listen
sure.
to Happy Inside?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
It's not you. It's the glow of the party. The way that you've got me lit up inside. It's the song that they're playing, the words that you're saying. It's never felt so right. And I'm the kind of person who starts getting kind of nervous when I'm having the time. Is there a word for the way that I'm feeling tonight? Happy inside at the same time. You got me smiling with tears in my eyes. I've never felt so high. No, I've never been this far off of the ground. And they say everything that goes up.
This is sort of maybe emblematic of what I struggled with on this album, which is the sort of trickery and the winks of the first two Kacey Musgraves albums, they did end up being a little too cute, kind of in sum total, but they did mark a specific idea and approach to country music songwriting.
Yeah.
Now, it's not that people have never done that before. I think if you look in the 60s and 70s, there's plenty of stuff like that. But
I mean, wordplay is like very much a central part of
it. Yeah. But there was no, I feel like her, the restraint with which she does it, like very much like in a tight space. Like she really does maneuver. She really pulls like a U-turn in tight spaces.
Yeah.
And you actually hear that on a song on this album called Space Cowboy, which is something that.
And that was the co-write, the Shane McAnally co-write. And you know, that's his, you know.
Shouts to the god,
Shane.
To the god, Shane McAnally.
You can hear him. It's like, all right, this is Shane. Like,
also, Shane McAnally, get your ASCAP money, my guy.
Like, yeah.
Seriously.
No, for sure.
Seriously.
And, you know,
free my guy's $1 million.
That was like, and you know, she had co-written almost all of her other songs with Shane, you know, on her first two records.
Right.
So this was like the last vestige of the Shane McAnally era of Kacey, if, you know, not to give him credit for her success, but at least that sort of creative. She very consciously was like, I want to not work with the same people all the time.
I think they were simpatico.
Yeah, no, they're chill. Sure, they're like, he was like, yeah, go do your thing.
Right,
like,
but on this, that's an outlier. An outlier.
Yeah, for sure. This.
So Happy and Sad feels maybe a little bit more emblematic.
Yeah.
Tell me about why this resonates for you.
It's hard for me to explain because I don't like love it. Like I'm not like, oh my God, I get this song. But I understand what she's going for and I appreciate it. You know, she's trying to kind of dig into emotional complexity and ambiguity in a way that she never really did on her first two albums, with the exception of maybe like It Is What It Is or something. Yes.
You mean in a personal sense?
Yes.
Yep.
And like she's trying to figure out how to express that. Like she said when we were talking, she was like, I'm so sick of having to go over every line 5 times and like try and figure out the exact right word for the right thing. And like,
it's like a crossword.
Tie everything. Exactly.
It's like a crossword puzzle. Like, yeah.
Tie everything up in a neat little lyrical bow in her words. And she was like, I just wanted to stop doing that. And so this is like, it's a little looser. It's more expressive. And she's like trying to get at this thing that she can't quite articulate, but like she's presenting this scene and it's like, I understand what she's getting at there. Like, you know, you're really happy and you're simultaneously sad, like scared that that's going to go away in any moment. And that's what she's trying to express with it. And I think it's like, I just like that one, she's taking some risks by not doing the same thing that's worked for her all the time. And, you know, I think it's still evocative. I think on the content side, like you, like I struggle with it a little more. Like I get where she's going and I respect the ambition, but it doesn't necessarily always execute properly. But like aesthetically, I love that she's neither doing the total retro throwback thing or doing glossy country pop radio stuff. You know, she's sort of fine. She's trying to carve out a middle road with this like slightly whimsical, psychedelic, like poppy, but still traditional. Like, I think it's a really cool kind of aesthetic. And it's really her right now. You know, it feels she had like total creative control of this record and that's what she wants. You know, I don't know.
Should we play another song that sort of speaks to that? Should we play, what do you think? Maybe. Oh, What a World?
Yeah, that's probably.
Oh, What a World? All right, let's play Oh, What a World.
I mean, I hear, like we're talking about, there's definitely kind of this, like, you know, connection to Lynyrd Skynyrd and some, like, rootsy, bluesy rock and country rock and stuff. But I also hear a little bit of how that got reinterpreted in the 90s by, like, Hootie and the Blowfish, which you're making. Look, I feel like there is. There's a 90s moment happening in country, a little bit Cheryl, a little bit Hootie, you know, that's like the way that country and rock and pop got married at that exact moment.
So
that
you're paying hearing a high compliment, peace to the yes, Lord, Darius yes, Rucker?
Okay. Yes.
All right.
Yo, Darius is still out here. I'm not going to shit on Darius. He's killing Darius. It. He's making hits. He doesn't even care. He's doing his thing.
Hootie vibes.
But like also Cheryl vibes. Like I've heard a little bit of both of them. Just like the way that the guitars were presented and like kind of the riffs that the guitars are doing. The fact that there's a lot of guitars. The fact that some of them have a little bit of distortion. Kind of the combo though is like really a pretty approachable, you know?
Yes. I also think, and the particular sort of like melange of influence points. And this is like, you talk about Hootie. Hootie cast? Just throwing it out there.
Look, I think there's a serious like 90s revival Cheryl moment. Like that's a bigger discussion.
Also, yes. The Musgraves album recorded on Cheryl's property.
And I talked to her. I was like, I hear a little bit of Cheryl at moments on this song. Kind of like beachy California vibes. And she was like, yeah, okay, I can hear that.
Also, shouts to, didn't Best Coast recently cover If It Makes You Happy? I feel like Best Coast and maybe like a couple other bands.
And you know what?
Ilk.
And I talked
maybe
to
Sadie from Speedy Ortiz also?
I don't know double check about that, but I believe
someone fact checked me.
Also, Maren Morris has cited Sheryl Crow as a big influence, which you can very much hear
true
on
story.
Her album.
True story. My favorite R&B singer, Maren Morris. There is a sly bit of trickery in place on this album that is different from the previous sly bit of trickery. Her sleights of hand in the past were lyrical and cutesy and whatnot. But I do think this sort of broader aesthetic shift is, you know, I don't mean trick in a malicious way, but it is a little bit of a trick. And the trick is we have somehow spent three albums, four if you count the Christmas record, on Kacey Musgraves and never talked about what her voice is really like. Mm-hmm. It's not something that comes up a lot, I don't think. And I'm not never, but I feel like I would like to see more writing and more thinking about what her voice does, can do, and also can't do. As I was listening closely to it on this record, I feel like it's very thinly contoured. She doesn't sing with a lot of power.
No.
She traces shapes, even with a knife, I would say. Like, she's sharp.
Yeah.
I don't mean like
it's
in pitch.
It's a very like conversational kind of way of singing, you know?
Right, but there's not a lot of boom in the singing. And I think maybe if we sort of reverse engineer some of her career, a lot of the song choices may have to do with how she can sing and the ways in which she can sing and also the ways in which she can't sing.
Yeah.
Like if you think of great female country singers of the last 30 years, more often than not, they have large voices.
Yeah.
Whether it's Reba, Carrie, Faith, Martina, even Miranda in her way.
Miranda has a huge voice. What are you talking about?
Yes,
she's
not like Carrie though.
Depends on when you hear her.
Okay. All right. Yes. You want to give us the 30-second report from the Prudential Center?
I mean, she's just a legend. She was so good, and she was clearly in post-breakup mode. RIP Anderson East, Miranda Lambert.
Oh, is that a wrap now?
Where have you been? I sent you the Taste of Country link. How did
you not pay attention?
Anyway, she was doing like sad songs. She did Bathroom Sink. And I was just I don't even, you know. She does not have to try. She can just open her mouth and it's just like, bah, perfect vocals every time, you know. And like you can just feel that she's really struggling with stuff when she sings. Like when she starts the set, she's like a little cold, not totally into it. Halfway through, she's just like, it's all hanging out, and I don't even know. She'll change your life. Go see Miranda Lambert.
Go see her if you can catch her on this tour. And that is a good transition for us to talk about Ashley McBride. Ashley opened for Miranda on a recent tour run. That part of the tour is over, so you cannot catch both of them.
They're actually the whole tour is over. Now she's doing her little Big Town co-headline tour next.
I went to Nashville, as I said, to talk to Ashley McBride. I first became aware of Ashley around this time last summer, when the video for a song called A Little Dive Bar in Dahlonega came out. Let's listen to that song.
Here's to the breakups that didn't break us, the breakdown wrong turn that takes you
to a little dive bar in Dahlonega. Meet a girl outside Atlanta. Man, when it's hit rock bottom, smoke them if you got them. Nothing's going right. You're just singing along with your drink raised. A pretty little blonde thing's looking your way. Taking the best of the worst day.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Every now and again, I feel like Bill Friskick's Warren or Hazel Smith out here. Rest in peace to Hazel Smith. Rest in peace to the god, Hazel Smith. And I just think songwriting. Mm-hmm. I just feel like I'm one of those weird, corny, like, old Nashville people who's like, the truth of the beauty is the writing, and these kids are not... And
three chords in the truth.
Seriously.
Like a current Chase Rice song. Sorry.
Does Chase Rice know three chords?
Oh! He's going to throw his gold record in your face or however true. Well the song is
I'll melt, it down.
Is
I'll melt it down. I'll get a tooth made. So A Little Dive Bar in Dahlonega, the first verse and the chorus I think are phenomenal. I just think they're incredibly beautifully structured. Our voices... It's just so certain, and it has soulful edges at the outside, and it has a little bit of rock tension, mm-hmm. but it's very sturdy. And I found this song incredibly appealing, and I did not know if it was going to be a total outlier, but I remember last year I was really into it. I put it on my Songs of the Year list, and now she has this album, which is called Girl Going Nowhere, that has maybe another five or six really excellent, emotionally intimate, beautifully written, carefully executed songs that I find really impressive. And I went to Nashville to talk to her about them. And Ashley McBride, great energy. She was knocking back whiskeys and cans of beer and yada yas. And when the manager's assistant.
What's a yada yas?
Yada, I don't know, yada yas. And when the manager brought in a whiskey that had, I mean, I don't drink, so I don't know what these are. Like whiskey.
Yeah, John is really impressed by people drinking.
At all. It's a true story. Whiskey stones, is that a thing? Do you know what that is?
Yeah, the thing instead of ice, so yes. It doesn't dilute the whiskey.
Thank yes. you, Natalie.
That's why I'm here, for my expertise in alcohol.
At least one of us is drinking.
I'm not drinking. There's no I would like to note that there are no
not
beverages
on, podcast,
on the table.
Podcast after dark. Someday, Pedro, right?
It's 5 o'clock.
Someday we'll somewhere. Do someday podcast after dark. Oh my God. Okay. So I'm putting that out there now, sometime in summer 2018. We're going to do podcast after dark. So when the manager's assistant brought her like the whiskey with the whiskey stone, she was just like, hipsters with the, you know, like whatever. Right. Like, you know, she, uh-huh. she, good attitude, loads of tattoos. She has a dedicated artist who does all her tattoo, mm-hmm. like specific woman who does them. And it was very refreshing for me to talk to like a quote unquote new country singer who's 34 years old, who has lived a life, who has been through things, who did not succeed right off the bat, who was not hired because they thought they can look
can
like Taylor Swift.
I tell you a secret, though?
She's
feel
not
like,
34?
No.
Oh.
But I feel like there are more new Nashville people who are actually really old than anyone. No, but seriously.
Speak
because
on it.
When I was at Billboard, there were people, country singers, who would not tell us their age. You
that's
know,
why
like
you got
men.
The research. That's why you have a research department.
Well, we don't have a research.
Okay.
We didn't have a research department. But, like, it was just, you know, so some of these guys are out here, like, you know, selling themselves as younger, but they're actually, like, early 30s. But anyway.
Any name? Anyone on. You want to name?
I don't even remember who specifically, but I just know that just, it's an ongoing thing.
Do you think we should just do a thing where every day at the same time we tweet the actual age of a country singer?
I mean, I feel like John Party, you know, he just got famous recently. He's not young, you know.
But
I mean,
then they're trying to sell him as young?
No, but
I can't tell
he's
under that
new.
Hat. I can't
he's
tell
new.
The hat's
so okay.
Obscuring.
Also, can I do a very tiny John Party detour?
Yeah.
Okay. So, because
he
opened.
Say impression.
No.
Ashley McBride did a John Party impression.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
She was like, sometimes I wonder, like, when am I going to have a boat? And I asked John Party, and John Party was like, well, we'll see, Ashley. You're going to get a boat sometime.
That's so cute.
Yeah.
Well, he was opening the night that I saw Miranda, and I actually, like, really enjoyed it. I mean, I don't, like, dislike his songs, but he
I think
was
he's
like.
Good. His first album's really good.
He kind of, like, had some bangers, and. Also, his shirt was unbuttoned, like,
what?
To here. I was like...
Mark Anthony?
I don't even know. And Miranda came out, and she was like, you're welcome, ladies, for John Party. I was like, Miranda, have you seen John Party? But anyway, he did this song called All Time High, which is, like, an album cut. It was really good, and I've been listening to it a lot. And anyway, so, recommendation.
Shouts to John Party.
John Party deep cut.
Who was sort of like a neo-traditionalist.
Yes. Oh, for sure.
But has that changed on the more recent stuff? I haven't been paying as close attention.
I mean, he definitely, the Dirt Off My Boots is more rockish than Head Over Boots. It's just really funny that those are his two singles. It's fine. No, country music is good, I promise. But yeah, anyway, Ashley McBride, back to
Ashley McBride
at hand.
I was very struck by a couple things on this album. One, although I was not conscious of it in the moment of listening to it, I realized after interviewing her and talking to her about it, there is no autotune on this record.
Mm-hmm.
Most mainstream country has a tremendous amount of it. Even some of the singers we think are good singers still use it in sparing fashion. No autotune at all on this record. It reminded me a lot of, I almost felt like it could have come out on like Rounder or New West.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't feel I mean, alt country is not a real thing, but it didn't feel like it was coming from the mainstream major label country world. But that may actually have a lot to say about the mainstream major label country world actually being pretty all over the place right now.
Yeah.
And the central ideas that have kind of animated the genre at various points over the last 5-10 years all having kind of collapsed. Like, you don't really see the bros anymore. The bros gave way to the gentlemen. The gentlemen are kind of losing their center. And then they're still there. You know,
I mean, I looked at the country chart as I always do before I come on this,
as you should,
podcast
every
the
morning.
Top 30, shut up. The top 30 songs on the Hot Country Songs chart right now are all by men. And they're all by like the main. It's like there's a Chris Stapleton song and a Luke Combs song and everything else is like the same old dudes. So
that's a lot of lettuce.
Yes, a lot of lettuce. And the top song is that Bebe Rexha, Florida Georgia Line song.
God. Still?
Yep. Anyway, Ashley McBride. But
is this your king? Is this your queen? Bebe Rexha?
Not my queen. I don't know why you're looking at me.
First of all, shouts to Bebe Rexha for being from Staten Island and having a number one country song. Shouts to Bebe Rexha for being a tremendous red carpet presence. Anytime I've seen her interviewed in any kind of like celebrity,
yeah,
like dippy celebrity context, Bebe Rexha,
she's a pro.
Yeah, like maybe I should do like a Metropolitan section story on Bebe Rexha, like chilling in Staten Island with Bebe Rexha.
You should.
That's kind of a hot idea, and nobody steal that. Nobody do that. Okay.
He cuts it out of the podcast.
No, we're keeping it. Just nobody do it. No one's allowed to do it.
Okay, so no autotune. What else captivates you about Ashley
Again,
McBride?
I really like the songwriting. So mm-hmm. She has a writing credit on every song on the record. One is a total McBride and everything else is a co-write. Her detail work is really strong. She's interesting. She doesn't write a lot of love songs. Mm-hmm. There is a song on the record that is called
Andy, I Can't Live Without You.
Correct. In parentheses. Yes. Andy, paren, I can't live without you. That is the closest to a love song. That and American Scandal.
Yes.
American Scandal is kind of like abstracted. The hook is
American
about
Scandal
Kennedy and Monroe.
Is a rougher version of Taylor Swift's style. That's my.
That is a. It's a hot take.
It's not hot. It's literally what it is.
No, hot in the sense that it's on fire because it's burning down all the other takes. That's how real
it is. It's a good
is.
Song, but it's like, it's just a very similar theme. And Kacey Musgraves actually has a version of that same song on her album called Velvet Elvis. They all are playing on the same thing.
I can't wait to go to that DJ night. Where all these songs are being played.
Yo,
what bar, bar in East Nashville is
I
playing these three
songs? I was thinking about how Style and American Scandal would mix together, like, in my head. I was like, somebody's got to do this mashup. Like, I'm hearing it.
Pedro?
I'm staying out of this.
No. Pedro might do a slight mashup. Just we're going to leave this in, and if Pedro does it, he does it, and if he doesn't, he doesn't.
But I'm so can I offer my take? I agree that I really like some of the songs on the album.
Yes.
Like, they're very touching and cool, and I don't know. I'm into it. But I'm going to say that I think she's actually taking a strategy that's not so dissimilar from what Kacey did on her first album.
Okay.
Like, her, as far as subject matter, content-wise, I mean, Merry-Go-Round and A Little Dive Bar in Dahlonega are sort of flip sides of a similar theme. Sort of, you know, sharply observed tales of small-town life. Ashley's is more uplifting and like positive, like it's more like empowered, like this is our town and but we're happy to be here, you know, we know that it's hard scrabble whatever, but like we're into it and it's great. Whereas Kacey's was like, oh, this is sort of depressing that nothing in our town ever changes.
But you don't find that Kacey's either implicit or explicit politicization on those sorts of songs is different than what McBride is doing? Because to me,
no,
McBride
I do think
is,
it is different. It's more McBride definitely embraces it in a way that Kacey
never
does. Yeah,
like it's not questioned in McBride.
Sure.
Like she takes the traditions at face value.
I just think it's interesting that that's what it takes for a woman to cut through is to write about it, like sort of like small towns in general rather than personal experience.
Although speaking of personal experience, there is a song on this record that is maybe. I don't know if it's overtly political. It's certainly quasi-political, and that's the title track, which is Girl Going Nowhere. So let's just quickly, let's listen to the empowering song, Girl Going Nowhere.
Don't waste your life behind that guitar. You may get gone, but you won't get far. You're not the first, and won't be the last. You can tell us all about it when you come crawling back. That road you're on just winds and winds. You're spinning your wheels, wasting your time. But when the lights come up and I hear the band, and where they said I'd never be is exactly where I am. I hear the crowd, look around, and I can't find an empty chair. Not bad for a girl going nowhere.
You think that one's political?
I do, because I think it's about the limitations placed on women by various patriarchies.
That's interesting. I didn't even think about it that way. I just thought about it as somebody who's like defying the odds in general, you know.
Well, partially because the backstory of the song is a high school math teacher asked her what she wanted to do. She said she wanted to write songs for a living, and the teacher was like, that's stupid, you'll never do that.
Yeah. Well, he might have said that if she was a man too, to be fair.
Yes. Also, wow. Is that like post woke? Like what?
No, I'm just saying. I think songwriting is generally viewed as like not a very stable career.
True.
But I mean, and you know me, I am always one to jump on the let's fight against sexism bandwagon. That battle, I'm always willing to fight that battle. But I don't know if that's the particular one. Strike me as the most explicit example of that. I thought Fat and Famous was much more.
Yes, about Fat and Famous. And just as a quick sidebar, there was an extraordinarily troubling quote that Ashley McBride gave to me about some advice she received early in her career that I would like to read. So speaking of men in positions of power telling you what you can and cannot do.
I love this song.
Yeah, it's great. Why do they keep playing it, though? Okay, so Ashley McBride played French horn and was studying at Arkansas State to
band
be a band.
Unite.
Shouts to everybody I ever played in a band with. I played trombone.
I don't think I knew that.
Did you not? I must have told you that.
I don't think so.
Oh, wow.
I played cymbals in marching band. He was imitating playing a trombone in case that wasn't clear from the sound.
Got my slide game up. Okay, so Ashton McBride was studying at Arkansas State, and originally she would play in Memphis. It was maybe like an hour or two drive to Memphis. So she would play bars in Memphis on the weekend. And at a certain point when she felt that she was ready to go to Nashville, she would go to Nashville for weekends. And eventually this began to impinge upon her schoolwork. And she had an instructor. I think she said the class was a pedagogy class. So a pedagogy class to become a band director,
sure,
or a band leader, I guess. And she said at one point after one of these long weekends, she was talking to the instructor, and the instructor closes the lesson book. This is how the scene in the movie goes. Closes the lesson book and says, and this is a quote, which you can read on nytimes.com, but you're getting it here on nytimes.com/podcast. here's the advice, and this is in Ashley McBride's voice. He said, quote, "You're skinny, you're pretty, and I think things will happen for you, and in 5 years you'll be fat and nobody will care." That's a weird way to say, "I give you my blessing." That's her saying that, not him saying it's a weird way.
Right.
So just speaking of kind of all of the circumstances surrounding, and Ashley McBride is someone who, you know, I remember this is in the mid-2000s. So if you were a female country singer arriving in Nashville in the mid-2000s, odds are someone was telling you to look like Taylor Swift.
For sure.
Or to try to sing like, or dyeing your hair
blonde.
Yeah,
no, I talked to Natalie Hemby when I was still at Billboard. Sure. And she told me she was trying to be a performer, obviously, as many songwriters start out as. She was told very explicitly, like, "You're not pretty enough," you know, like, it's just like, and that was, and now, you know, how many hit songs has she written?
And also something I was struck by, and this is also in my piece, Ashley McBride was making the label rounds a couple years ago before this most recent series of label meetings that resulted in a deal. When she had an EP out, which is called Jalopies and Expensive Guitars, which is where Fat and Famous is on. We'll get back to Fat and Famous. And she said that even at that time, she was being told, and this is when she was 32. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's one thing if you're a young person who comes to Nashville, like, people think they're going to mold you. It's a terrible thing, but that's the game. But as a middle-aged, established performer, she was being told to lose weight.
32 is not middle-aged.
I don't know what, I don't honestly know what part of Popcast we have just dipped into.
Well, I'm just, I don't know.
That's not middle-aged, what am I?
It's not middle-aged.
Okay. 32, as a 32-year-old.
I don't want to think that I'm within a 5-year radius of being middle-aged, so it's not middle-aged.
I guess I don't want to think I'm in a 10-year radius of death, so like, so, okay, I guess fine. Let's just say 32. But it's the fact that that was something that she was still engaging with. You know, if you look at the album cover for that EP, her hair's blown straight. Like, it's the look is very different.
Right.
And now when you talk to her, or you see her perform, it's an entirely different proposition. Extremely comfortable. Like, she seems completely at peace with where she's at and who she is. And is the way that this record came is, she delivered the record in full. They recorded one extra song, which is the last song, which I don't even think is that good. Home Sweet Highway, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's unnecessary.
Yeah.
To me, the records on here that are excellent are Tired of Being Happy, Girl Going Nowhere, Dahlonega, Andy, like these sort of very, very detailed.
I think
detailed.
The best one is Living Next to Leroy.
Living Next to Leroy.
Yeah.
About the opioid crisis.
Yeah. I thought that was like,
or I guess meth.
That was the one.
Meth. She said it's about a meth.
She said it's about meth.
She said it's
okay.
About meth.
Yeah. I don't know. It seemed like it could be kind of about a number of different kinds of addiction.
Right.
Yeah. That was the only one I think on the album. That one and Andy, I Can't Live Without You. Those were the only two that like really like knocked me on my ass. And I was like, wow, this is, Because I've never heard anybody write a song about addiction that was like happy. You know,
yeah.
She did it in the kind of like in a matter of fact way that I think like really changes the tone. Because, you know, usually songs about addiction are like really tragic. And, you know, they are often great, too, because it's very fruitful subject matter.
Right.
But like this was just kind of like, hey, you know, this is life and this is reality. And like we're going to sing about it and tell the truth. But like this is how it is. And I really liked the way she approached that one. To your point about her appearance and her sort of defying convention as far as Nashville aesthetics. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that is the most subversive thing that she represents, you know, more than her songwriting. Her songwriting is great. Like her aesthetic is cool. But I mean, it is shaped by Jay Joyce, who's a very established country super producer.
Yes.
You know, Eric Church, Little Big Town.
Yes,
like,
he is not an obscurantist figure.
No.
And also she signed to... This is like, these are things that like we only talk about in Nashville conversation, but like she signed to Q Prime management. That's Eric Church, Brothers Osborne.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like she's not moving on the fringes.
Right. And that's the thing I think is like the discrepancy between how she's being positioned and where she's at. I mean, she has very serious heavyweight allies inside Nashville, but I think that because she presents as somebody who, you know, doesn't look like every other woman country singer. I mean, Kacey Musgraves came in not looking like every other woman country singer just because she had brown hair and a nose piercing, you know? So Ashley McBride's presentation is like miles different beyond that. And I think that's awesome. And that present, like, that means that there's more room for women to like actually be themselves and not like a facsimile of Taylor Swift or whoever or Carrie Underwood or whatever. Like
and
in the same way that Chris Stapleton like means that not every male country singer needs to look like Luke Bryan or whatever.
Although to be fair, there's echoes of Gretchen Wilson. There's echoes of early Miranda Lambert. Terry Clark is someone who Ashley and I talked about quite a bit. Like, you know, it's not without precedent.
Not without precedent, but I mean, in the current landscape,
but she is still, and a thing that I did find kind of both charming and also very grounded about her is she is someone who, despite the fact that she moved to Nashville in the mid-2000s, like really didn't find any success for almost 10 years, any notable success. She got a publishing deal 2 or 3 years ago, has never had a song cut, or at least not before 3 months ago when she became a thing herself. She was very resentful about that. I think she did not want to openly blame her publisher, but like it certainly seems like she was struggling with that. And there were still some of the kind of moments that I imagine the average Nashville aspirant takes for granted. She still found hilarious and a little weird. And I just want to read something that she said to me that I didn't put in the piece, but I thought was really funny. She was talking about the night that she did the showcase where she met her manager, who's this guy, John Peets, who runs Q Prime's Nashville office, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So she was basically saying, like, you know, he just walked up to me and, like, you know, it was like the room parted and he, like, shook my hand. He's like, my name's John Peets. I know what to do with you. And, like, we're going to do business.
Right.
Like, very direct. But she was like, it was so different than how most of the conversation typically goes backstage. She's like, first of all, who are all these people and why are you backstage at my show? That's, like, one thing. And then she was like, quote, people coming into the green room and saying, I find them to be very strange sentences. They're like, you can drive my boat sometime. And I have all God's money. And I own a leprechaun. And have you ever pet a Pegasus? And I sort
That's
of admired, I admired that she was at least able to see the BS for what it is and theoretically cut through it. Although the way she's cutting through it is, say, not that different from, Eric Church, who cuts through it, but also with a deep reverence for tradition, incredible songwriting, and like a kind of like stoicness that is sort of
but
a sales
like,
pitch.
It does mean something to have a woman able to occupy that role in that way. And
hell yes.
I think that that is significant. If she does find the same kind of success that Stapleton or Eric Church or whoever has had, you know, I think that's awesome.
Okay, so we've talked about Kacey Musgraves, an ostensible genre challenger who maybe is not. And then we talked about Ashley McBride, an ostensible genre challenger who definitely is not. Natalie is ferociously shaking her head no. So
that's not bad. I'm not mad at not challenging genre. It's fine. It's good.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, I have no problem with it. I don't think that's really her sales pitch anyway.
Yeah.
But so we have those two things. But country, in a bigger way, is having this moment, a decentered moment, where I don't feel like there is as much of a through line, despite what you said earlier about the, oh, I don't know, 30 biggest songs in the country all being by basically post-bros.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I'm not sure if there's as much of a centrist narrative as there has been maybe 2 years ago or certainly 5 or 7 years ago. What's going on?
To me, it seems like you have all the standbys. I mean, you have the stadium guys, the Luke Bryans, the Jason Aldeans, the whatever. You know, they're still going strong. They're not going anywhere. They have hits. Like, I can't believe Luke Bryan's current song is called People Are Good or something. What is it? It's like,
it's like People Are Happy or People Are Good.
Something just that's really incredible. But anyway, and the number one song is still by Florida Georgia Line. So, like, really not much has changed in that department. You know, they're still doing their thing. Bros, duo, you know, rocking country, whatever.
Tattered jeans.
But exactly. But kind of below that echelon, there's a little bit more conversation and tension. You know, we've got the Chris Stapleton school with Luke Combs as his like direct follower.
Yeah,
you know?
And sort of like your Dave Cobb and Dave Cobb adjacent guys.
Yeah.
You talked to Casey Musgraves in your interview about this.
So I just asked her, you know, because she's one of few kind of critically acclaimed country singers who's not working with Dave Cobb or Jay Joyce. You know what I mean? Like, it's an unusual choice. And so I asked her a little bit about how she felt that this trend was a trend, you know, that like kind of rootsy traditionalism was a trend. She said, "This album is traditional with pop influences in a way. I like that kind of thing. But one thing I've been thinking about with the Americana movement being so strong, I feel like it can be a little not sedentary, but one-dimensional. Though I love Americana and roots music, it feels like there's a contest sometimes with how country or how traditionalist you can prove yourself to be."
Where is the lie?
So we have the Dave Cobb category of the world, which, you know, very popular and probably the only part of country, as we were talking about, besides Casey, that has kind of mainstream crossover, whatever.
Yes.
And then we have the Sam Hunt and post-Sam Hunt world of R&B country. We're still waiting for new Sam Hunt. Sam, please, please, anything. We need new music. I'm like, my
Sam Hunt's one of the 5 or 10 or fewer contemporary musicians who the mere thought of a new song makes me deeply inhaling.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot. So we're waiting on that. And then
yum.
We've got like this world of ladies, and I think there are a few kind of
Carly Pierce.
Carly Pierce is down there. We've got Raylan, we've got Cam,
Queen,
you know.
Yes. Raylan is, I would love to find my way into Raylan. It has not happened.
I don't like the new song. I'm not that into it.
But she's such a great character, and she was such a great character coming off of Idol.
Yeah.
It'll happen. It'll come around. The Idol has a Raylan figure this season. Have you seen?
I haven't.
Her name is Layla Spring, I believe.
Okay, I've heard the name.
She's Raylan 2.0.
Okay.
If we're already ready for
that. But yeah, it's like there's really not. It's Maren Morris is probably like Maren Morris and Kelsey Ballerini and Miranda Lambert and Carrie Underwood
Warren
are still like
Elena.
Yeah, she's getting up there.
That record's not bad.
But like just as far as women who have any kind of mainstream credits, like those guys and not that many others. And then we've got an upstart in the mix, Kane Brown.
Oh,
who's out here. He's ready to change the game. Like, I didn't really, he kind of snuck up on me personally a little bit. He didn't sneak up on other people, but like, he has a really good voice. We saw him we went to his concert.
Yep.
But he was the one who knocked Sam Hunt's Body Like a Back Road off of its record setting streak with his song What Ifs, which is a duet with Lauren Elena, who is his childhood friend, which is really cute.
You say, what if I hurt you? What if I leave you? What if I find somebody else and I don't need you? What if this goes south? What if I mess you up? You say, what if I break your heart in two, then what? Well, I hear, girl, I feel, girl, but not so fast. For you make your mind up, I gotta ask. What if I was made for you and you were made for me? What if this is it? What if it's meant to be? What if I ain't one of them fools? Just playing some game. What if I just pull you close? What if I lean in and the stars line up and it's our last first
has a great voice, really good like pop country rock sensibilities. Like he just like he has good taste.
But
in
he
songs.
Sounds like Randy Travis.
He does. And that's the thing that sets him apart from all these other dudes is like he really has a very distinctive voice. And so he's executing songs that really could be cut by just about anybody in mainstream country, mm-hmm. but they sound different when he does them. And Heaven, which is currently number two on Hot Country yep. Songs, like it's a really good song and it's very R&B inflected. Like it's very much something that Sam Hunt could kind of in another world record maybe. And he's posting these teasers on his social media of like very Sam Hunt-y vibes, but him doing them. And it's like, it made me freak out a little bit,
he's
but then
coming for the throne.
I know. And he's really, really successful in a way that a lot of, you know, it took Sam Hunt kind of a while to get to that level. And Kane Brown has kind of just like overnight, like, whoop.
You remember when people used to agonize over Jason Aldean rapping? That just seems like a zillion years ago now.
Right. And the important distinction to know about Kane Brown, if you're not in country, is mm-hmm. that he is biracial. Yep. And so
that is not unimportant.
Yeah. And he's actually very open. I spoke with him and he's very frank about it, very open. And he talks about how it has been challenging at points in his career. But of course, you know, Nashville is all love, everybody's family, blah, blah, blah. But like, it's really very significant. You know, like when you look at the history of country music, there just are like, you can count the number of successful mainstream African-American country singers mm-hmm. on one hand. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that he has
Are you counting Cowboy Troy or no?
I'll leave that distinction to you.
Sorry.
But he's definitely, he's one that should be getting mainstream attention and is not, in my opinion.
I 1000% agree.
Tattoos, common thread.
True.
Kane Brown has a lot of tattoos. Ashley McBride has a lot of tattoos.
So let's go out with some Ashley McBride. So I did a bit of a deep dig mm-hmm. on Ashley, and I discovered a lot of old YouTube clips. You know, she's been playing bars since the mid-2000s. So if you go back far enough, you find stuff from like 06, 07, 08. And then you find some more recent stuff, but before she was brought into the world as we know her now. And the clip that I was most excited about was a performance of a song that I think was ended up on the EP, if I'm not mistaken. It's called Fat and Famous. This is a hilarious song. She wrote it. I talked to her about it in the interview. She wrote it sort of as a commission for a 10th anniversary high school reunion.
That's cute.
Where the people she went to school with, and this is in Arkansas, basically said, write a song about us.
Oh, my God.
And Ashley was like, well, you guys picked on me. And I was not a cool kid. And, like, I was in band. And you guys were all, like, the pretty mean girls. Mm-hmm. So she wrote a song called Fat and Famous, which is about how everyone else who went to the school
got fat,
got and super washed, and how she
and how she's famous.
She's just like, she's got endorsement deals, and she's got hits, and she's playing shows every night, and it's uproarious and it's tremendous. And let us close this week's podcast with Frizzy, you got fat, I got famous.
It's a great flex.
You made fun of me on Friday nights. I was down there in the band. You were up there in the stands. And now who's voted most likely to hate their life? You got fat, I got famous. Ain't that funny how it changes?
That's our show, which is both fat and famous.
Hey, fat with a PH.
Of course. We're really, the 90s really are back.
Right?
Thank you to my guest, Natalie Weiner, for sitting and talking about country music with me for an hour.
Thank you for having me.
Yeoman's work.
My pleasure.
Please listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us about, I don't know, like a Hootie Cast or whatever. I'm
Hootie
flexible.
Cast.
A Cheryl Cast. Like, I'm super open to whatever you guys are up in the mood for.
As long as it's one of those two things.
Yes, no, not another thing. But email us at podcast@nytimes.com and share your feelings. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thank you for indulging us having a snow week last week. We wanted to leave you with all that good time to soak in the Ashley Simpson two-part extravaganza and then give you a little bit of downtime. But we are back and we are not going anywhere. See you next week.